an acting commissioner who actually, it is the minister's intention that the acting commissioner is appointed, and we're just ensuring this goes through the right processes in Parliament. So thank you very much, Ms. Zodwa Ntuli, Commissioner Zodwa Ntuli, for being here with us and your team. This is a sharp instrument if we are going to transform the economy and the structures in the workplace. Thank you very much. And the suit, Mr. Hermans, if you... Are we ready to go, Mr. Hermans? Right. Can we... And the DA said apologies for a minute. They've just stepped out. I'm not sure why, but it's something or other. It's to do with the party. But we need to continue. So please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. We want to thank you again for the opportunity to just share with you our strategy. We're going to try and be as brief as possible so that we can give more time, Chair, for the things that the committee would like us to respond to specifically. Chair, my name is Zodwa Ntuli, and my colleague on my right here is Busisiwe Ngwenya, who is responsible for the compliance section of the work that we do. And on my left here, I've got my boss here, the DDG, Mr. Sipho Zikode. So obviously, as you are aware, the DTI is the policymaker and the BBBE Commission is the implementer of what has been developed from a policy perspective. Chair, we're going to skip some of the slides, but it doesn't mean that they're not important. It's just that we just want to give you what you actually interested in knowing about the work. Just going through the first slide, just to remind members of what our vision and mission and the values are. We must reiterate this again because sometimes what we do gets to be confused with what people would like to see or what people are debating outside. But our mandate is guided by what is in the Act and what is also in the policies and the legislation that and the regulations that the Minister will issue from time to time. So in terms of our mission, we are there to facilitate the accelerated productive implementation of the Act. And again, Chair, we emphasize the word acceleration because we think that from 2003, the pace with which BBBE has been implemented has not been to an acceptable level, and we're hoping that as we continue to implement it this time around, that will ensure that it is accelerated and that the results are achieved much more quicker than what has been over the period. In terms of the vision, our vision is obviously in line with what our National Development Plan is focusing on, that is the inclusive economy that is globally competitive. So there are people that when we talk transformation, they tend to want to say that if we talk transformation, we want to talk empowerment, then it means that we're not going to be globally competitive or we're not going to be friendly to investors. But those things are not mutually exclusive. So we do believe that an inclusive economy is going to hinge on attracting investors, but at the same time on our entities nationally continue to remain competitive outside. So our values are also outlined there, Chair, but I'm not going to go through them. But just to indicate that, again, an inclusive economy for us is a priority. So whatever we do, an inclusive economy is a priority. And if we go back again to our constitution and you look at the aspects that were recognized around income distribution that is not appropriate, the ownership of productive assets of this country, the inequality levels and all of that, those are the things that we need to make sure that we achieve a parity on as we implement the legislation. Chair, the next slide is really the slide that we have all the time, just to remind people where we come from and where the Commission started and where we are now. So in terms of effective operation, the regulations were passed on last year on the 6th of June by the Minister. Only then could we start working. So other work that we've been doing, we're doing outside the legislative mandate. So in terms of the legislation, we started operating on the 6th of June. And so we started, obviously, receiving complaints and stuff like that from the 6th of June. So the coming June will be the year, 1 year of our effective operation. Again, Chair, just to remind members in terms of what are the elements that we are implementing in terms of BBBE. We're looking at the level of ownership because that's one critical element. It is a priority element. We're looking at management control, that is black management control in entities, and then skills development, supply and enterprise development, as well as socio-economic development. All of these aspects have got various points that are allocated as companies are achieving them, and depending on how many points you accumulate, then it will determine which level you are from level 1 to level 8, with 8 being the least transformed from a BBBE perspective. These are the objectives of the BBBE Act. Chair, the reason why we have this slide is that members will realize that from these objectives, if you look at our mandate as the BBBE Commission, not all of these things can be achieved by us. So if you look at, for instance, the objective number 7, which says promoting access to finance for black startups, SMEs, cooperatives, black entrepreneurs, including those in informal business sectors. Certainly, we do not have a mandate to facilitate any funding to anybody as the BBBE Commission. So it is important that government realizes that the role of other government departments and state-owned entities in achieving this objective is very critical. So that is where we find, obviously, some of the incentive schemes in DTI that are focused on providing finance to black people. That's where you find the role of the NEF, for instance, as an entity that finances black businesses and so forth. And you, again, if you go to the next objective next to that one, which is objective number 8, which talks about increasing effective economic participation and access to financial and non-financial support. That is where you find the role, for instance, of the Department of Small Business Ministry, and so the Department of Small Business Development. That's where you find the role of SEDA, your CIFA, and all of that. So all of the objectives that are in the BBBE legislation are the objective for empowerment in its broad context. And our role there is limited to ensuring that the legislation is implemented properly. So that's where we leave it in terms of the objective, is just to put them into context, just to realize that for transformation, for black economic empowerment to happen and to be effective in this country, you need the whole of government to actually do it. And if they don't implement it consistently and for a longer period of time, then we'll not be able to actually change the economic landscape of this country. So the ownership patterns will still remain the same, or at least if they do change, they will change as slowly as we have seen in the past 10 years. The next slide is really about our mandate, and on that slide, the strategy that we will be talking to you about emanates from this mandate. We cannot do anything that is outside this mandate, because otherwise then obviously we'll be acting ultra vires. And so we are guided by this. But I think what we appreciate a lot, Chair, is the mandate to monitor and supervise and promote adherence to the Act in the public interest. This for us is extremely broad and allows us to monitor what is happening in the market. And what we have done obviously in that process, for instance, is that we monitor, for instance, the media on a daily basis to see what's happening around black economic empowerment. And where we see things that for us raise concerns, then we'll follow up on those. So that's the broadness of the mandate, that we can actually get also tip-offs from people without necessarily formally lodging complaints, where we can actually just receive tip-offs of what is happening somewhere, and then we can then enter there and try to look at it. So this mandate is, for us, is broad enough that we don't have to get into a formal inquiry to deal with an aspect. So some aspects we actually intervene, and we are able to resolve them by assisting the entities to do things the right way. So, Chair, I'm going to leave it at this point for now and allow my colleague, Ms. Wisiwe Ngwenya, to take you through our strategy, and then I will just come and summarize at the end. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner, Chairperson, honorable members. Thank you for this time. When we were doing our strategy, we were guided by the National Development Plan of the country. We also looked at the DTI's medium-term strategy, but more than anything else, the BBB policy or legislation itself, that's what guided our strategy, and also the Black Industrialist Policy, because if you go back to the previous slide, yes. When you look at the previous slide, we were talking about the objectives, we were talking about financing. It's one of the things that the Commission has just indicated that we cannot do, but then we said what processes can we put in place to support those kind of programs that are not within our mandate. And also the new growth plan was our guiding principle. Now, the operational situation, I'm sure the chairperson is aware that the commissioner, the acting commissioner, was appointed on the 6th of September 2015. When she was put into place, there was nothing, I mean, absolutely nothing. We had to come out with everything from scratch, yes. And what we did is that we contacted the state-owned enterprises just to get a sense of how possible it was for them to implement the BBBE or what were the hazards in them implementing the BBBE. And also we contacted some stakeholders because we wanted to get the feel of the land to say what are the challenges in implementing the legislation. And then based on that, then we found that there was no significant progress in transformation. In fact, when you look at the national status of transformation report that was published in March, which you can get on our website, but also we can, I think we did forward it to the members. If not, please let us know, we can send it. It shows that we actually have not moved. In fact, we are regressing. So when you look at JSE-owned companies, you might find that the number of women have increased, black women have increased in directorship, but then you find that the number of black male would have gone down. So if we had 13% of males the previous year, and then this year they say we have 16%, you'll find that it's just a swapping, where black female now will be 16%, and then the black male will be 13%. But also what came out from the study is that black foreigners are actually increasing in the JSE-owned entities. So when they say we have so many black people, it does not necessarily mean that they are gains, but it just means that, yes, yeah, yeah. And then also what we find is that there's a lack of understanding of the Act itself and the code of good practice, which is what is causing the challenges that we're seeing. And also that there's no credible or reliable data on the state of BBBE or transformation. I think, Chair, if you recall, when the NEF was here previously to present on the financial sector code, they mentioned the 3% and vis-a-vis the 21% that has been put across by JSE to say there are so many black companies. But then when you drill down to it, you realize that actually it's not the 21%. Maybe they are looking at the indirectly ownership. And one thing that is also prevalent that we found is the issue of fronting practices, that they are rife, and also that there's fraudulent BBBE certificates that are being handed out to people. One of the reasons is that your exempted micro enterprises and your qualifying small enterprises are not required, if it's 51% black owned or 100% black owned, they are not supposed to get BBE certificates. They should be getting some affidavits. But what has been the practice is that the verifiers are still issuing BBE certificates to those entities, and then it makes those certificates illegal because they should be using some affidavits. But also, what you find is that a BBE certificate might say a company is level one, but when you drill down to actually find out what this level one looks like, you find that it's not really what the paper is written on. So, yes. And some certificates, you find that they are still issued on the old codes, and I'm talking about the ones that are not under certain codes that are not finalized yet.
There's an urgent clarification.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted, or I request Ms. Ngwenya, to go back on what you were saying, what percentage is it that is supposed to get certificates?
Okay.
I mean, affidavits, not certificates.
For the sole affidavit, if you are called an exempted micro enterprise, normally we use the term EME, if you are 51% black owned, you get an automatic level 2. If you are 100% black owned, you get an automatic level 1. And then if you are a qualifying small enterprise and you are 51% black owned, you get an automatic level 2. And then if you are 100% black owned, you get 100% black owned, you get an automatic level 1. And those companies, all they need is a sole affidavit, which is available from the TTI's website and template. And also what has been put into place is to say when you register a company, for instance, with CIPC, you can get a BE certificate, but that certificate must only be issued by CIPC because they are not supposed to pay for that. So that's the only certificate that they can get if they don't go the sole affidavit route.
So, Richard, just to indicate that the EMEs, the exempted micro enterprises, are the companies and close corporations and all of those that are less than 10 million. And then between 10 million and 50 million, those are qualifying small enterprises. So that is the difference. So the reason why the decision to not have them verified was to reduce the cost of doing business for those entities.
Forgot about that. And then you also have what you call large enterprises. Those are companies that have over 50 million turnover. Then those ones, as the commissioner was showing, the five elements have to comply with all those five elements. And the acting commissioner. Yes. And then they need to be verified. Thank you. And then also what you find is that there's poor verification processes and gap in regulating verifiers. And when you look at this, we had a meeting with one verifier, and what they said to us is that they do sampling. And, I mean, this is not an audit process. When you're doing verification work, you actually have to interview. If they say they have a black director who holds, like, 51%, they actually have to interview that black person. Also, they must go and do site visits just for them to satisfy themselves that if the company says it's transformed, is it really transformed, not just on paper. Because normally the person will say, I'm a shareholder, and then we say to them, can you see the shareholders agreement? And then you see that in the shareholders agreement, they actually are not a 51%. They don't have that. It's just on paper, but the majority still sits to the person that holds 49%. So we're saying that when they do the verification, they must actually talk to that person and verify for themselves. They can't do sampling because this is not an audit process. And then another thing that we're pushing for is to say the sector codes, they all need to be revised and aligned so that we're all working from the same page. I mean, because currently you're saying it's causing confusion in the market to say we're talking the revised Act of 2013, but then some sector codes are still under the 2003 Act. And we're also saying that this should not be a tick box approach where companies are just pushing to get points, but actually it should form part of their strategy. When you're doing your strategy as a company, we're saying that there's even government departments, they must start looking at triple B as part of their strategy. Yes. And because that's where you actually, as government, you can see real transformation when we make triple B part of our processes. And then what we've also seen is that there's an increased request for advice and clarification from the commission, from the entities. One of the things that we looked at was also a SWOT analysis. I will not go through each and every pay line, but I will pick some of them. One thing that you said is that as a team, we think that we've got a dedicated team and expertise, and that we also are clear about our mandate and the framework that we're working under. The weaknesses, some of them, is that we didn't have office space. We're happy to announce, Chairperson, that as of today, we'll be operating from the National Gambling Board offices, but this will be a temporary arrangement because we don't think the space that we've got would accommodate the expansion that we're looking at. But at least we've got our own. Yes, yeah. And also, one of the weaknesses that we identify was issues of financial and human resource constraints. But also, we're happy to say that what we have done is that we put in place a graduate training program to say, much as the commission is not listed currently, I think we are aware of that, so it cannot appoint its own staff.
but then we can start a graduate training program where we get graduates to come in and already start with working at the commission. And then the opportunities that we have seen, one of them is that we can raise revenue also for ourselves, and this will be through the advisory opinions. And I think if you look at the commission, they've been doing that from the word go, but then we just feel that the amount that they're charging might be low. We might need to just maybe peg our hours a little bit higher. Yes. And also that we have an opportunity to build relations, and we've already started doing this by meeting with entities like your special investigative unit, and then on Monday we're also meeting with the National Prosecuting Authority. So those are collaborations that I think are also going to assist us in actually implementing the legislation. And then the threat is saying that if there's a lack of political buy-in or will, that might stymie our work. And also maybe the negative reports that might come out where people are talking negatively about the legislation and not supporting the transformation agenda, that might also be a threat to our work. And the circumvention also of the legislation. Now, for us, we think that these are the focus areas for the next 5 years, because what we have done, Chairperson, is that we have combined the APP and the strategy, so it's just one presentation. We're giving two presentations. We're saying that we're seeing our objectives as following: safeguarding the outcomes of an inclusive economy, implementing corrective enforcement to achieve compliance, and then we're saying research is going to form a key part of our work, and then collaborations, as I mentioned, with relevant stakeholders, and also developing capability and capacity for the Commission to deliver on its mandate. Now, within the Commission, we have put in place 5 programs. We have what you call compliance. It's not on the slide, but I would just like to mention quickly. We have what you call compliance. We have also investigating and enforcement. We have stakeholder relations. We have administration, and also we have research. So those are the programs that you've got in place that are supposed to deliver on the objectives that I've just mentioned. What we've also done, I'll just go through quickly to say, well, these goals, they tie in, if you look at them, at your national development, your NDP, your outcome 4, your outcome 11, and also your outcome 12, where we're talking efficient and effective and development-oriented public service. Now we'll get to the meat of the work. So under compliance, what we looked at is that there's a need to guide the implementation of the legislation, and also we need to assess the BBB transactions and provide advice. Now, as members might be aware, the minister is supposed to publish the thresholds for major BBB transactions, and part of that, our mandate will be that we'll then assess all those transactions and then provide a report to say these are maybe if we've got challenges or we feel that those transactions are contravening the legislation or are not in line with transformation, then we can actually issue that report and say they are not complying. Can they fix in this area or that area? Now, with the guiding of the implementation, what you're looking at is issues of advisor opinions. This is also on your complex matters where companies will write to us and say, can you please provide us with an opinion to say, would the commission be happy with us if we implement this transaction the way we intend to implement it? And so far, I must say, this has been going quite well. Chairperson, you started this process last year. We give ourselves 30 days to provide an advisory opinion, but you also offer what you call clarifications. That's on interpretation of the legislation. And then with those, we give ourselves a turnaround time of 5 days. And so far, with the average has been 3 days. So I think we're doing quite well. And also what you do is that you issue out what we call practice notes or guides. That's where maybe a matter will come out repeatedly where the people are asking for interpretation. Then we'll do a guide so that we send it out to all our stakeholders just to say this is how we look at a particular matter. For instance, if we're talking about the EMEs and QSEs, we issued out a guide to the stakeholders just to clarify our position on that stand. And also we will look at the issue of developing a leniency program in line with the Competition Commission one, where we think to people, we're not just using the enforcement arm, we want them to comply. So the leniency program to say, if we have contravened the legislation, but it's not so severe that we need to prosecute, then we'll use the leniency program. Moving on to page 13. Page 13 talks to our enforcement and investigation unit. Their role is to receive complaints and investigate those and provide a final report with recommendations. Unfortunately, unlike your CIPC and your National Consumer Commission, you don't have a tribunal. So all our cases that need prosecution have to go via a magistrate court, which is why we need this collaboration with the National Prosecuting Authority. But also what we're putting in place is the issue of mediation to say not all matters we should go via courts, because then you're defeating the whole purpose of making sure that people, the wrong that has been done to people has been corrected. So we're looking at also doing mediation wherever possible so that the settlement agreements and matters are concluded as quickly as possible instead of going through the court process. Now, also what the Act gives us is that if, for instance, somebody wants to give us a tip-off or they want to complain anonymously but they don't want to be known, then as the Commission, we can initiate that investigation on our own. You don't necessarily have to lodge a formal complaint as the person that's being aggrieved. And then under research, as mentioned, that we are fortunate that now we've got that unit running. And we've already done some research. Like I mentioned, that we had the national status on transformation research done. We also had a benchmarking report that was concluded and done, which are also on our website. But here we're looking at a trend to see what's happening. And with the compliance report that companies are the JSE listed companies and state departments that are supposed to bring in, we'll be able also to inform the members when they come back next time to say, this is how the country is looking like in terms of transformation. So this unit is going to play a major role in actually bringing out those stats and trend analysis as far as BBB is concerned. And then we, under stakeholder relations, as I mentioned, that we're getting into collaborations with identified stakeholders. We have already put into place a memorandum of agreement with the National Gambling Board, which has been signed. And then we've also got final drafts with the Competition Commission, your CIPC, your National Liquor Authority. And we also have put one with a special investigating unit. And then we'll also be looking into putting one also with your NPA. So these are processes that are ongoing. And once they are signed, we'll also inform the committee. And then under administration, what we looked at when we were doing the strategy was that because we are a new entity, we don't have our own systems in place, we had to come out with an ICT strategy, first of all, to say how do we want, what kind of systems and processes do you want to put it in place. And also what we looked at was the issues of the portal, which has been launched, and the issue of case management system. And we're also happy to report that we currently already have our own financial system being put into place. And then we'll also be coming out with a human resource system and a performance management system, which the Commission will use as soon as it's listed, because currently we're using the DTI's processes. And in terms of the staffing the Commission and developing our own pipeline, I did mention that you already have a graduate training program. And we're happy to announce that as of today, we already have 18 that are in the program, and 6 are starting today. We also looked at the issue of risk management, because it's all good and well to have all these grand plans, but then there might be things that might not make it possible for us to implement. The issue of new ICT infrastructure to support the Commission, we said we need to develop and implement an ICT strategy. And then the issue of inadequate human resource to deliver on the mandate. When we started, there were 6 of us who were seconded from the DTI. Currently, we are standing at 8, and then we have 3 employees that are on a contract term. And then, as I mentioned, that we will now have 18 graduate trainees. So all in all, we have 31 staff people serving the Commission currently. And also what you're saying, that you also look at the issue of multi-skilling the internal staff. When you look at me, for instance, much as I'm doing compliance work, also there's a research element that comes into it. I also assist with strategy. And other colleagues also, they are not just focused on one area of their work. We all are getting multi-skilled so that you can never say there was no enforcement person, the work could not be done. We try and assist wherever possible. And then issues of insufficient financial resources to effectively execute the Commission's mandate. When it started, there was no funding at all. And then during the 2016-17 period, the DTI gave us 20 million. But then when the Commission gets listed, you can realize that this money would not be enough even to cover the Commission's salaries. But then we think that there will be a need for reallocation by the DTI of the budget for us to be able to really deliver on our mandate. And also the issue of non-compliance by the stakeholders. But then here I must say we have been doing quite well in terms of information sessions and education stakeholders. And now we react on invitations because people are starting to become aware that there's a commission, they want to get information. And also through the clarifications, I think we're giving them advice. And then we're saying that another issue would be maybe litigation where people are not happy with some of the findings or our recommendations. But then we said that we put into place a proper investigation plan, which we have done already, and then that you need to get an adequate legal support to support it. The financial plan, as you can see, is quite conservative. For 2017-18, we're looking at 112 million. But currently, we must say we only have 20 million. For compensation of employees, we said we need 66 million. Goods and services, 26. And then payment for capital assets, 20 million. And for the first financial year, we must remember that we are getting everything from scratch, which is why the payment for capital assets is quite high because we're getting our own printers and computers. But moving forward, you can see that number goes down. And then 18-19, we're looking at 107 million. 2019-20, 110, 2020-21, 119, and then 2021-22, 128. And then this is our human resource plan. As I mentioned, there's only 31 of us currently, but for 2017-18, we're targeting 113, so for us to be able to deliver fully on the mandate. As you can see, we're really under-resourced. 118, and then that number will be retained throughout to 2022. Thank you, Chairperson. I'll hand over to the Acting Commissioner.
Chair, as you will see from our strategy, we are connecting the compliance work, which has an impact on our investigation and enforcement work. So in terms of compliance, what happens is the more people become aware about the work of the commission, the more complaints we receive, all right? And the more requests for clarifications we receive. So in the beginning, we do expect that the work of the commission from the complaints side of things will still be high as well as from the request for clarifications. But as we go into the coming years, we expect that at least we'll have less complaints because more compliance would have been focused on, so that we limit the number of complaints that we're getting. Chairperson, it's also important for us just to give you a sense of why we believe this strategy is going to work, because we have already started on the work that we've outlined to you now. So last year, up until the 31st of March 2017, we already implemented some of the activities that we've just outlined to you. In terms of the advisory opinions, which is the advice that we give on specific transactions, we've already done 48. And as Busi has indicated, in terms of our turnaround times, we give ourselves 30 days for an opinion to be issued, because it's much more complicated. You've got to go through all of the agreements, all of the shareholders' agreements, and all the finance agreements to determine some of the things that are in there. And our turnaround time so far, we're doing very well in terms of 25 days. And I think we are also seeing an increase in terms of those requests now coming up, so we expect more in this financial year. In terms of clarifications, Chair, we have done about 391. And our turnaround times as well for these ones
is 5 working days, and we've managed to give them within 3 days. So I think we believe that the quicker companies get advice, the better they'll be able to implement triple BEE. So advice and opinions and clarifications for us are very critical. And then in terms of meetings with stakeholders where we discuss transactions, where we discuss the legislation, we discuss schemes, whether it's an enterprise or supply development scheme or whatever it is, where we sit with the companies and we go through all of those and we give them advice on the spot, we've had 189 meetings last year. And some of these, Chair, are just walk-in meetings, like where people just come in and then they just call when they are downstairs and they'd like to speak to somebody in the commission because they are busy with a particular transaction. And then in terms of the complaints, this, Chair, includes both complaints that we have initiated ourselves and the ones that have been submitted by the complainants. We have 218 complaints. Some of these complaints, although we didn't, for this purpose of the meeting, we didn't break them down into how many we've already closed, because we've closed a number of them, a majority of them predate the implementation of the amendments in 2013. So in some of them, we do not have jurisdiction. So in some of the cases, we do have jurisdiction, and we already are at final stages of the reports. We've issued 12 final reports on some of the investigations. The parties that are investigated have got 30 days to respond to our initial findings, and so they are still given the opportunity then to respond to the findings. And then in terms of the initiation, Chair, we must indicate that we have initiated an investigation in respect of 5 verification agents, and this emanates from some of the issues that we've picked up in the investigations that we are doing, as well as some of the flaws in the processes for verification. So we've proactively initiated an investigation to look into the affairs and the conduct of those verification agents so that we can then be in a position to correct whatever is not right in that space. And, Chair, in terms of the compliance reports, you'll recall that we spoke about the JSE listed companies. They are required to give us annual reports, compliance reports. And those, it's in terms of Section 13G, it's the JSE listed companies, the CETAs, as well as government entities like organs of state. So the ones that were required to report immediately were the JSE listed companies. We expect the government entities to now start reporting because their financial year end was the 31st of March. So the reports are required within 90 days of the end of the financial year. So we'll start receiving the ones from government. But from the compliance reports of the JSE listed companies, we must indicate that the pace was slow, and what we've done is that we've sent now reminders, and they were supposed to now update their report and submit by the 30th of April. And we will check now as we go to the office, because that would have been last Friday. So we'll check in terms of how many we've received. But at a time when we left the office, we had 50 out of the 138 reports that we were expecting from the JSE listed companies. And then in terms of the BEE transactions, as we've indicated, the minister has not issued the threshold yet, but the transactions are taking place. So as we monitor the market, we pick up some of those. So we've already had assessment of the transaction that was done by Avenk. Avenk is in the construction sector. It's a transaction that involves a sale of 51% to a black company that is they're selling part of the business of one of their subsidiary. And then there was Pinnacle. Pinnacle had done a BEE transaction that involved a foundation. And there were concerns about that structure in a sense that it wasn't really a BEE transaction because of the way the foundation was structured. So we've gone through that. We've given them the areas that they need to be amending, and we're waiting for finalization of that transaction as well. The ArcelorMittal transaction, it's almost the same as the Aveng one. It's a 51% sale. It's a B transaction where there's a portion of shares that are being sold to a black entity. And so we had to go through the detail of the agreements to determine whether it's indeed a BEE transaction. And then we've got SKF. We've also called on that one. It was also announced. If you check in the papers, you'll see that they've announced that. That also involves a foundation. And the challenge with the foundation's share is that people take normal foundations that are not ownership, and they want to pass them as if it's ownership, like it's a broad-based scheme. So it's important for us to go into the agreements and into the detail of those foundations that are being created to see what part of it is actually a BEE transaction. Then we have the Adcock Ingram. Adcock Ingram also did an employee share scheme, and they've announced that they had an initial one. They've got now the second one, and there are concerns about that scheme, that it's not actually an ownership scheme in terms of the detail. MTN, we have looked at the MTN Zakhele Futhi. That is the second MTN triple B transaction. Again, Chair, our concern about the type of transactions like the MTN one is that we need to find a clear distinction of what an investment scheme is and what an ownership scheme is. So we had to also go into that transaction to assess that. Then there's two other transactions that we had to look at. That is a consultancy called SER, as well as the consultancy called Net Value Holdings. These two, Chair, they are selling models, ownership models, to companies to structure their BEE deals, and we found some concerns that are raised about them, so we had to go into those transactions. So we're still in the process of finalizing the detail of the transaction. With the Net Value one, Net Value was instructed to stop the model because it wasn't an ownership model, and they continued to actually sell the model still after our instruction. So in respect of Net Value, we've now initiated a formal investigation to then take action against them. Chair, in terms of the fraudulent certificates, Busi has indicated there are a number of certificates that are flying around that are fraudulent. So we have issued declarations in respect of 46 certificates that are declared invalid. And what we'll be doing now is to put all of these things also on our website so that people can see which certificates are invalid, and so that when companies look at them, they can see that, okay, this is a fraudulent certificate, or at least this company had a fraudulent certificate. And in terms of the another long-term solution also to this fraudulent certificate share, Busi has already indicated that we have developed a certificate portal. So all of the certificates that are issued by verification agents now will be found on the portal. So there will be a single point where all certificates in this country will be there. So if you are a state-owned entity receiving a BEE certificate from any person saying we are a level 2 company, you can then check against the portal. So everyone will have access to the portal. At the moment, it's not accessible yet, but it's going to be accessible on our website. So you can actually just put in the name of the company or the certificate number, or you can put the company number that you want to search. So then you'll be able to verify whether the certificate that you have in front of you is actually a valid one. So you can check against the portal. So the portal has become effective from the 1st of April. And what is happening currently is that all verification agents had to register on the portal, so they are in the process now of activating their accounts, and some have already started uploading the certificates, because they must upload each certificate as they issue it, they must upload it on the system. And then, Chair, the last thing that I just wanted to also indicate is that in terms of the accurate reporting on what the state of transformation is as a result of triple BEE, because in this financial year we will not be able to give a report because the regulations came in the middle of the year. So we only did baseline studies so that when we start issuing those reports we can have something to compare it to. Yes. So we've done that study by we commissioned Who Owns Whom. They've done that study. It's available on our website. And we've also done the benchmark study that looked at the BRICS countries and how they have actually approached the implementation of the triple B legislation. All of those studies are available. Lastly, Chair, the assessment that we do on black industrialist applications, the DTI does send applications to us to look at to determine whether there's fronting or not. Chair, with the requirement of, I think in terms of the application requirements for the black industrialist program, that incentive scheme, they're looking at companies that are 51% black and above. So what you typically will see is that companies from 2014, 2015, you know, some companies would have suddenly become 51% black. So which then is an initial indicator that there may be fronting activities. But you can't conclude without looking at the detail of now that ownership, what rights go with it. So we are looking, we're providing the support to the DTI in respect of those assessments. And in all of them that we've already looked at, we were not happy with the ownership structure, yes. So in the ones that have been brought to us, the ones that we've assessed, we're not happy with the ownership structure, because what you find is that the 51% black shareholding so 51% shares is in the hands of a black person. But if you go into the agreements, there's no power that comes with that 51%. The entire power sits with the 49% shareholder. Even the account, the 51% black shareholder doesn't even have access to the bank account of the company. So those are the things that we're saying that we should be concerned about, because we also don't want to create black industrialists in paper. But then as you then, you know, go back, then you come back and then we say this didn't work. But then we must make sure that it works from the beginning by assessing the ownership structure. Chair, we'll stop at this, and if there's any other things that we didn't cover in the slide, we'll be happy to talk to that. Chair, I'm not sure if the DDG would like to say anything, but on our side as the Commission, we're done. Thank you.
Very much, Commissioner. Did we say DDG? Was this the Chief Director or the... Oh, yes, of course. I'm just looking at your face now. Yes, okay. But we've got both a Ms. Rodkin here. Is that right? Yes, Chief Director, Office of the Director General, representing GCOO. Right. The Group Chief Operating Officer, is that right? Thanks, go ahead.
Sorry, Shana, I just want to acknowledge that it was me and to give an apology for Ms. Scott, who isn't here.
No, thanks very much, Chair, and the honorable members. Chair, as we have heard the presentation from the acting commissioner, we are now on our way, really. There has been some teething problems at the beginning. We hope by the third quarter of this year, the commission will be fully fledged, fully registered with the Treasury. At the moment, they are still going through the necessary process to register the commission as an entity of the DTI. Yes, they have moved now to their own space. They are no longer up the campus. And we are also looking at the budgetary issues, as we have seen the plan over the 3 years. Unfortunately, the commission came at the wrong time within government when there are all sorts of cost containment and the limited budget that we have. But but the plans are in place now, Chair. And really, as the members have seen, the work of this commission is to deal with three main issues in the economy. First, for us, it will be to advise the market out there on how to deal with the issues of compliance with the law. and advising the market out there when they structure their PE deals. I think that's the main function, really. This is not the commission that has been established, you know, to go out there and start, instituting legal proceedings and all those things. But obviously, you see, out there in the market, there are also bad guys, to be honest. People who are getting all sorts of business from government based on the false pretense that they are empowered companies. So the commission has to deal with those people for corrective action. They have to really to follow what the law is saying and all the mandate that's been given by the law. But also, I think their work is also to deal with the issue of the verification industry. You know, the BEE policy and the programs, unfortunately, they have created an unintended industry, which is called the verification industry. And there is a lot of things happening in that industry, you know, like the commissioner has presented. There's a lot of corruption in that industry itself, where people give false certificates that do not really represent the reality. So their work also, you know, is well cut out there, dealing with the verification industry and ensuring that they follow proper, verification processes. So we think. We, as the policy developer, we have now the implementing mechanism in the form of this commission to assist the market there to transform. I think I will stop there, Chair. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, GDG Sakordi. Thank you, members. I think now's the time for us to engage directly on this. We have the Honourable Williams, we have the Honourable Olifant. Is that correct? I saw a hand here. Who was it? No, Van Skalkbeek, I meant. Is it yourself, Mantash, you had a hand up? Okay. Honourable Williams, Mantash, is that it? Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I've just got two questions. Firstly, on slide 9, you say under threats in your SWOT analysis, you said the lack of political buy-in. I just need you to explain that to me. And secondly, I'd like to know what happens to the companies that are caught with fraudulent BE certificates, the 46 of them, and if nothing is happening to them, why not? Thank you.
Honourable Mantash.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. We appreciate the work that is done by the Commission. And I have no question but a comment, Chairperson, that says I wish they would not look into the newly established companies only or those companies that were white-owned, but also look into our SOEs because they're flouting our regulation and before we raise as the Parliament, we had interaction with many state-owned enterprises, and unto them we have seen how they don't adhere to the triple BEE, and by so doing defeating what the DTI is trying to do. I can quote them, your PRASA, your Transnet, your ESCOM. Can you please look into them? Because they are also culprits. They're trying to, you know, they're undermining the regulations and the laws that we're enacting in Parliament. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Commissioner, I have a clarification on the financial, on the budget. I was told by our researcher that the budget was $200 million per annum. Then somewhere else, I think content specialist is telling me it's $20 million a year. And then when I looked at what you've got here, it would appear as if the RAND is in millions, as I understand it, and then the compensation from employees then would be, if you make it millions, then you're looking at $66 million, you see. So I'm just wanting to get some confirmation. If it indeed is $200 million, I think I heard the DDG saying, you know, it's just unfortunate that this great entity has come at a time of fiscal constraint. And you've already pointed out that you're on these small but sort of premises. They're sufficient at the moment, but they are unlikely to suffice in the future. But they are sufficient as we sit here. Then you made a comment about resources without mentioning finance or human resources, about indicating that you're working with very constrained resources. And I do know the two are linked. But in particular, do you have sufficient human resources to be as effective as you would have liked this to be? And the last aspect here would be this, what would appear to be a deliberate distortion of the BBBEE Act, as say it would appear to be. And certainly from what you are saying about you getting so many, you're looking at 49 of these, and all 49 are problematic, as it were. Now, as you started this work in this, since in the 6 months, as it were, whatever it was, June last year, what would you say the position is? Is there a concerted effort from the private sector and state-owned enterprises to embark on transformation? Or is there a concerted effort to undermine it? Or perhaps undermine it would be the incorrect word, but certainly not be as proactive as we would have liked. In other words, you're complying because there's a sword over your head. I have to do this. If you could just clarify that, because this was always intended to be some flagship piece of legislation that would work with the public as well as the private sector. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the questions. Let me start first with the question around the lack of political buy-in. Chair, the one thing that we have found when we started this work and we were talking to stakeholders and we're talking to government departments, SOEs, the one thing that came out very glaringly was the fact that there's too many messages about BBBEE. And at some point, others had a sense that the government itself is also not serious about BBBEE because of, one, entities like government entities continue to undermine the implementation of BBBEE with no consequence, and also just in terms of the political leadership, their messaging around BBBEE has also been seen by the stakeholders to be very conflicting. So when we then say the lack of political buy-in, it will become a threat because we're trying to administer the implementation of something that we believe is government policy and is important. But if there are conflicting messages, then it makes the implementation very, very difficult, and it makes our mandate very difficult. So the lack of political buy-in means that if, for instance, our political principals speak in another tongue on this issue, then it gives also the market an opportunity to want to raise excuses about implementing it. So we really appealing there for a very consistent message around BBBEE, its importance and seriousness, because without that, our mandate will be extremely difficult. In terms of the certificates that we have found to be invalid, I think Busi can then touch on that. But largely, what we have picked up is that, hence we have initiated an investigation in the verification space, because certificates are issued by verifiers. So, and we don't want to say companies do not know what is it that the verifiers are doing and are looking at, all right? But a number of companies believe that the verifier is doing, you know, they know what they're doing. So when they issue them with the certificate, they're happy with the certificate. So what we've done is to, with every entity where we've picked up a certificate that is invalid, we've given them an opportunity to respond, to tell us why they have that, and then we, before we even declare it, we've given them an opportunity to tell us how they obtained the certificate, what happened, and so forth and so forth. So now, that is the reason why we have now initiated a wider investigation into the verification industry to deal with that aspect. However, some of the entities, we've asked them to withdraw the certificates and to even write to all of their clients and withdrawing the certificate, because often we speak that those certificates, the culprits are not the entities themselves generally, but the verifiers themselves. So that's where we're looking at. But Busi, you can touch on that issue, what we have done with the 46 companies that have been found with certificates that are, so where they are, you know, clear acts of fraud by companies, certainly those will recommend prosecution. But for the majority of them, it's been the verification processes that have not been done properly. And in terms of the SOEs, Honorable Mantash, the SOEs, like we reported the last time, we actually started with the SOEs. And what we've picked up is that initially when I spoke to the SOEs, SOEs kept saying, the triple PFA is a problem. That is why we can't implement BEE. And the triple PFA has now, the regulations have been amended. And we would like now to see the implementation without any hindrances, because that's what we were getting from them. But we're also concerned that the alignment with the triple B legislation is not as it should be for the SOEs. And where we have picked up the non-alignment, we have sent out letters to them instructing what needs to be done. The last time, Chair, remember that we actually asked about the SASA contract and whether even triple BE was a consideration. Our engagement with them has actually indicated that that was never a consideration at all in that procurement. So according to what Section 10 of the triple BE Act says, every state-owned entity, every government department, in its procurement, they must apply the triple BE legislation and the codes. So we are concerned about that, but we are dealing with them, like as we're saying, on a one-on-one basis now, because we have previously alerted them to that through specific letters to their entities, and now we are now taking up specific issues with each one of them. Chair, in terms of the question around the budget, I think Ms. Ngwenya tried to explain that. Because we started from nothing, National Treasury indicated that we will not have an allocation because there was a fiscal constraint about finances. And so we had to find money within DTI itself. And in the initial phase, DTI allocated 20 million to start the operations. That's where the 20 million comes from. But you'll see that in terms of our financial plan, the amounts that we need for each year are outlined there to adequately resource the commission. And Chair, the only advantage that we have now, even though we've got limited resources financially, the only advantage that we have right now is that we can use DTI resources like systems and all of that. So there's certain costs that are already absorbed by DTI. So in the meantime, we still are okay to operate, but we're not at a point where we can say we'll be able to operate optimally. But the DDG has already indicated the processes are underway. The plan is that the commission will then be listed separately as an entity, and it will have its own allocation effective from September. That is the plan, but obviously it will depend on the Department of Finance processes as well. All right. So once we have that, then at least we'll have a specific allocation, and then that will be aligned to the mandate and the strategy. All right. And then in terms of the Chairperson, you ask a question, do we have sufficient human resources? Chair, we'll never have sufficient human resources to deal with the BBB issues. And again, when we come to this to the committee, sometimes we're not sure how much information we can give, because when we give you information on certain aspects, then we give certain culprits an opportunity to actually assess our ability to come after them. So, Chair, on that one, I can send you information, but I think there's a level at which we can give you information in the public about our abilities. So for now, we are ensuring that we're building as much capacity as we will be able to build at the moment to deliver on the mandate. And then just in terms of the whether there is a deliberate distortion of BBB or whether the private sector is a concerted effort to undermine. Chair, let me say I won't be able to pronounce if there is a concerted effort to undermine. But the one thing that I can tell you, Chair, is that the fact that the codes were a bit complex for the market, that one is true. If you look at the advisory that we're giving on a daily basis, the kind of clarification and interpretation and all of that we need to do, it emanates from some of the provisions in the codes that are a bit complex. So that is a fact. So now, if you have confusion and the codes are not straightforward, it becomes difficult then to say there's a deliberate effort not to comply. So you've got to balance it. So we do accept that the codes were complex, and now the guidance and the clarification that we're giving is now beginning to settle that down. And then on the where we've given guidance, we are seeing compliance. We're seeing voluntary compliance. We're seeing people coming back doing things in the way that we've advised them. So I will say there's willingness where we have advised and where people are clearer, there's willingness to do the right thing. And then so that gives us comfort. But we'll be able to tell you whether, yes, there is resistance in some areas where when we sit down with people, certainly most companies are relying on consultants. So there's over-reliance on consultants. When you meet with these consultants, initially you can see the resistance in doing certain things. But we cannot then, you know, immediately translate it to say companies are deliberately, you know, disregarding that. But we think that the companies should actually start taking BEE seriously on their own and not rely on the consultants to do that for them. Because if it's not part of your strategy, you'll not even talk about it on your board. All you want to see is a level 2 certificate. How you got that, you actually really don't care. And then you come back and tell the commission that, oh, we actually just gave so-and-so the contract to do our verification. We didn't know what they looked at. We were not aware that they didn't calculate this and all of that. So, Chair, I would reserve my comment in that space maybe until a later point where we can, as the commission, say, indeed, maybe there's a deliberate effort to undermine transformation. But so far, at least on the side of compliance, we are encouraged.
I think we appreciate your frank response there, which indicates that there are some successes. There is some success here and there, and in other cases, it continues to be an uphill battle. It may assist us in how we should be dealing with this as well. It's heartening to hear that you are trying to work within the financial constraints within government and not simply giving up, but doing the best you can. And I see you've emphasized the need to train the learners, internships, etc., which will certainly help, I'm certain. And the access to DTI's resources will enable you, I have no doubt, to continue in this regard. But for some of us, it is a little disappointing that one of our sharper entities that was going to be used as an instrument to achieve transformation is to some degree having its goal hindered at the beginning. But I have no doubt, knowing you, that you'll be able to overcome this, Commissioner, you and the DDG and the staff concerned. But members, is there any other comments you wish to make? No, we will be tracking this and, of course, the budget itself, and trying to ascertain how soon we can see that increased, Mr. Zakorda. Okay, Sipo. Yeah. Thank you. No, thank you very, very much. I hope you don't go just yet, because there's a company here called Bay Hill. It's a company that I understand maintains that it is a fully fledged black economic empowerment company. Where is Bay Hill? Right. Now, if you'd like to come to the fore, the commissioner is here. She'll certainly be able, with her team, to assess how realistic this statement is. Because when I heard this being said, I thought, well, that is certainly amazing to see something positive like this. But the committee will also now be able to interrogate you on this particular matter. And I see here that we have... just look at the Bay Hill here. Is that Mr. Blunt, Managing Director, Mr. Moller, and Ms. Smith?
No, I
know. Here we are. Dr. Mashlati, the chairperson. And I understand Mr. Moller is the CEO of Citadel Investment Services. Our interest in the company is that it may well be a good example of this. We don't know. That's why we're very happy the commissioner is going to be here as well, you see. Is this company what it tells us it is, and its intentions, objectives, etc.? And we are, Dr. Mashlati and your team, going to hand over immediately to you to address the Committee of Trade and Industry. I would have to leave because there's been a bereavement. My senior staff member on the Chief Whip's unit passed away quite suddenly. So he's just addressing that. So please leave. That was the Honourable Hadebi. But do go ahead.
Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for the opportunity to introduce our transaction and what we intend to do to the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry, and of course the BE Committee behind us, or the, if you want, the Commissioner behind us. Could we have the first slide? AFG, African Financial Group, is the company that I chair, and we have been in transformation. Okay. We have been in transformation for the last 20 years, doing transactions. When we started, there was no BE Act. It was soon after democracy. Fortunately, now we have something to guide us. We started by doing transactions on our own, and we have used our own assets to collect money from ourselves first. Then we started mobilizing capital from doctors. We did a transaction with Netcare.
where we did that with a group of doctors, SAMDP. We did a transaction at Old Mutual, which we did that with doctors and lawyers and women groups. And we had our own companies, Sianda Capital, introducing emerging market people to the stock market. We've done that over the last 20 years. And we've come to a stage where we have now decided to get a partner that is well-versed in this sector of financial structuring, capital raising, as well as deal-making. We looked at a company that is not so big. Having worked with Old Mutual for the last 10 years, we knew how difficult it is to work with large companies to do what we wanted to do. So in Citadel, we found a partner that would be able to have the track record, the assets to be able to advise people with emerging wealth, and that would be credible. And behind Citadel is a credible company called Peregrine, which is listed in the stock market. Not so big, not so small, but most importantly, it had all the financial engineers, the intellectual capital that is necessary for us to do what the task at hand. Can we have the second slide? We have the CEO of Citadel here. I wonder if you'd like to introduce Citadel himself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, and honorable members. Citadel is a wealth management business. We are a 23-year-old wholly owned subsidiary of Peregrine Holdings, which is our listed parent. For the last 23 years, we've been focusing purely on providing advice-led solutions to investors. We are a fully vertically integrated business, which in financial services speak means that we own the chain. We have strong capabilities in advice. We have strong capabilities in solutions and also asset management capabilities. The relationship with African Financial Group and Dr. Gil Mishlati and the coming together of Bay Hill Capital was really just a logical progression of the relationship that we've been having with African Financial Group over the last few years.
Hi, I'm Jeff Blunt. I'm MD of Bay Hill Capital. Bay Hill Capital was a small business within the Citadel Group, and we specialized in building bespoke share and investment portfolios for our clients. But given the background of actually building customized, let's call it solutions, and customized investment product, when Dr. Gill and Andrew sketched a vision forward, we were ideally suited to participate in that and actually drive this vision. And I think that vision is one of the things I'm going to take you through now, and hopefully it gives you some ideas as a blueprint for, I think, the way the industry can operate going forward, as well as for corporate and business structures. So the rationale for the transaction really goes back not only because of regulations in the Triple BEE Act of 2003, which said that the private sector must investigate and facilitate and develop a plan for economic transformation, but because of a belief within the business as well that if we don't actually do something ourselves and sort of lead the charge, the potential is that it gets imposed on us. So we were quite excited at a personal level and at a corporate level to pursue this vision, as I said, which I'm going to take you through. One of the things I just want to highlight to the committee is we estimate that there's black wealth in the country of probably about 700 billion rand of middle-class balance sheet assets. And we think that, those savings can be mobilized to both create and drive transformation in the economy, but at the same time create investment returns for those investors. But I'm going to come through to that in a moment. Maybe just to talk around some of the considerations around BEE transactions. And I think this is a few years ago I was asked to give an economic presentation to the Reserve Bank. And I had the governor in the room, and I had to present on what I thought interest rates were going to do. And it's a bit like asking, coming and presenting to the committee behind me, a view on what we think of the considerations about BEE, when I'm sure that they could give us the lessons instead. But one of the things that, you know, we looked at is in many of the transactions, and I'm going to talk about our transaction first and what we've done, and then what we're going to do as a business model, is clearly when BEE transactions are done, often those transactions are debt funded. In other words, the new shareholder, the black shareholder, borrows money to buy those shares. Now you've got this ongoing payment every month, this interest rate payment. And if your dividends or your cash flow aren't sufficient to fund the transaction, it unwinds. Often they've got lock-in periods, 5, 7 years, 10 years, 20 years, before the investors can actually benefit from the investment. There's this issue of permanence of capital. You know, once empowered, always empowered, or does, if you lose your shareholders, does it change? And there's that debate. The issue of cyclical industries, you know, where you've got earnings of businesses that rise and fall, like in resources, how do you account for that? And then also in businesses where it's basically vendor financed. So, for example, you get a business that wants to bring in a black shareholder. Either they give the shares at a discount, or they loan the money, or they enter into some other transaction. But whenever you do that, it raises the cost of financing within the business, and there's some impacts there. Now, I'm not saying that these are negative or positive. These are all considerations that one has to take into account in terms of the transaction. So we kept it very straight and simple. AFG purchased 51% of Bay Hill from Citadel, and the background is as Andrew and Dr. Gill have sketched for to you, in that it was that there's been a two-year relationship, and we've sourced Citadel-sourced clients and been introduced to clients from AFG, and this is a formalization of the relationship. I think more importantly then is to talk you through the benefits of this and a win-win situation. One of the things we're going to be, which I'll take you through in a moment, is what we call the launch of transformational portfolios and the benefits we think that those can bring to society in South Africa and to investors. But, you know, if you don't eat your own cooking, it doesn't, you know, it's easy to try and sell something to someone else, but you've got to be shown to actually eat your own cooking in this. And the approach that we've done in this one is that the transaction doesn't raise the cost of capital for Bayo Capital. There's an agreed purchase price, and AFG purchased that. So the one lesson is that you want to have investors that have some capital to start with, rather than create complicated structures. We like the idea of permanent but not locked in. As a 51% shareholder, because of the size and the commitment of AFG into Bayo Capital, there's no lock-ins that AFG can't ever exit or on-sell their shares, but at the same time, when you're a majority shareholder, you're committed to the business as opposed to a 25% or 20% shareholder. We're looking for active shareholders. Okay, and I think one of the things in South Africa is that often you get a BEE shareholder in the business and they're quite passive. We want all of the stakeholders in our business pulling for the business. We're a relatively tiny business. So we want not only our staff, not only our clients, but we also want our shareholders to be actually working for our business and adding value at all of those levels. And we want an active shareholder that's going to drive and change the business and help us change the business and, along the way, hopefully bring some clients as well. But that's not the core rationale. I think also from an AFG perspective, AFG has a vision, which we'll talk to in a moment. For them, this is a method to fast-track the implementation of that vision of transforming the economy, because they're coming to a group that already has established intellectual property infrastructures and processes of the Citadel Group, even though we're an independent business to Citadel. Okay, so that's the background to the transaction. Within the business, and I think this is where I believe it's going to get interesting for the committee, is we have a couple of capabilities which are legacy capabilities within Bayhill. The first one is investment management. So this is building investment portfolios, share portfolios for our clients. The second legacy is financial planning. And just for clarification, for those that aren't in the financial services industry, financial planners will work with someone and build a financial plan or a financial roadmap with them. So what they'll do is they'll sit with you and you say, well, how much do you need for retirement? What are your assets at the moment? What are you going to earn over the next 20 years? This is how much you need to save. And this is where we think you should place those savings. So it creates a financial roadmap. That's the one half of the business. The other half is then once you've got that roadmap is you want to invest that money and put that money productively somewhere where it can grow and then achieve your end goal of having sufficient a sufficient investment portfolio or assets to retire on. And we also offer private client and stockbroking services. So in terms of the capabilities then, what we're focusing on, and I think this is a great example of sort of innovative thinking. Since for the last 20 years, there has been, and it doesn't always feel like it, but there has been the creation of a large black middle class in South Africa. There is that 700 billion rand sitting on black balance sheets, black investor balance sheets. But that money is invested in what we call traditional portfolios. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just the old-fashioned unit trust on the stock exchange or a policy at Sanlam or Old Mutual or anything like that. That money is not driving transformation. At the same time, because these investors and these portfolios or these assets belong to black investors, it brings with them some unique attributes. For example, the fact that if you're in a company and you're looking for investors, you want to get black investors on board. You're willing to actually create and issue shares to them at a discount to get them on board. So those are the types of things. So there are actually there's value, if you want to call it, in working with and creating what we call portfolios for qualified or black investors. So the background to this then is to actually target and look for assets and investments from qualified investors. Now the advantage is because we're not using financial tricks and imagery, we're actually going to investors that we offer the financial plan to. So we work with them, we build their financial plan roadmap, and then we say to them, one of the portfolios and places we think you should invest your assets are in the transformational portfolios. Now, these portfolios have two objectives. The one is to earn a good investment return for our clients and create wealth, but because we're targeting and because we actually can only take black investors into the portfolio, it means that you're actually creating black wealth. And the second one is to actually then transform the economy, use those investments to actually drive transformation in the companies that we invest in. Now, I mentioned a couple of the problems that one faces from a BE perspective. The first one is the use of leverage. So people borrow money to go and make an investment. Because we're actually going to investors and we're actually asking them to put cash into the portfolios, because there's sufficient capital to do that, we are getting over that problem. So we're removing the issue of leverage in the portfolio. The second one is of liquidity. And our goal is to build a portfolio of 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 billion rand of black capital. Now, the beautiful thing about once you build a large portfolio of assets is you might have individual investors coming and going from your funds or your portfolios. So they're investing. But if they want to go, they can exit. But your overall portfolio stays at a stable size, which means that when we go to companies that are either listed on the JSE or unlisted companies or black industrialists, those are the three pillars we're looking to invest in, they know that we're in it for the long haul and we're investing with them for the long haul. So we're actually putting money in and saying, okay, we're here for the next 5-10 years as such a strategic investor with you. So it almost makes that issue of once empowered, always empowered moot, because we're actually in there as a long-term investor with the companies that we co-invest in. But at the same time, because the pool of capital will allow our clients, new investors to come in and exiting investors to take units out, we're providing liquidity to our underlying investors. So that's the strategy that we're following. In terms of the listed investment strategies, this is to actually go and work with listed companies on the JSE and take strategic stakes. We're in the process of discussing and finalizing our first transaction. in which we can take a strategic stake in a listed company. Thereafter, there will be other transactions that will come along. So on the one hand, we're investing that money into these listed businesses. They issue us the shares at the discount, but we're not doing this for a tick box exercise. So the important thing is that if we come on board, they understand we're going to drive transformation in these companies. So we're not just there for the ride. Secondly, if the economic rationale for the investment does deteriorate, we can exit. So I'll remind the committee and the commission that investors in the African Bank BEE scheme still lost all their money. So this is not about BEE for BEE's sake. You've also got to have an investment motive and rationale for where you allocate your clients' money and allocate our clients' capital. And then thirdly, as we grow the portfolio, we would like to become an example of superb and excellent corporate governance and oversight of the businesses we invest in. But they come to us and actually ask us, well, how can they drive and change and transform their businesses? At the same time, also become a port of call for companies on the JSE that are looking for quality black investors, broad-based black investors that we will actually put and allocate these portfolios and funds into. But it's not just about listed shares on the JSE. We also want to look at unlisted companies. And the second two pillars here are black industrialists and black businesses. And this is not a case of financing someone to go and buy shares in other businesses. This is a case of actually looking and participating in black-owned businesses that are requiring capital as an investment. And there's two ways we do this. The one is will be direct investments, so looking at other companies and investing directly. And the second route is to actually participate in industry and government-sponsored schemes as well. And one of the advantages, one of the amazing things that the experience that AFG brings to the table is their experience in many years in financing and in getting involved in schemes like this. For example, medical facilities that are black-owned and black-managed. And then finally, if you want to call it unlisted white firms, traditional investment companies, where they know that they're actually going to drive transformation. They're looking for transformation partners and people that can play an active role, very much as the way AFG is playing an active role in guiding and managing Bayhill. We want to perform the same role in the businesses that we invest in. So a very simple, easy presentation. The first one is to actually create a transaction which we think actually mirrors what we believe and mirrors our belief system in the country. The second one is just to raise capital from black investors to then earn great returns for, create wealth, but also transform the economy. We don't think those things. We don't think transformation and wealth creation are opposite factors. We actually think they can work well together. They're not opposed to each other. That's it, yes. Thank you, yes.
Well, that was an overview of what Bayhill does and why I indicated to Mr. Hermans it was important that the Commission was here at the same time, because no, we're not authorities on what the BBBEE is in the first place, but what we are aware is that there have been challenges with the financial sector and their codes. This is not correct, Commissioner. In the past, there have been some challenges there. And maybe before the committee engages with Bayhill, you can just indicate just briefly what these challenges have been in the past.
All right. Thank you, Chair. Just in summary, our challenges with the financial sector code, obviously there are those that are more generic to all of the sector codes. Our view was that the targets that they were setting were not advanced enough, given where we are as a country. But in relation to the financial sector specifically, we had concerns about the transformation fund, the black business funding aspect of it, where they wanted to convert the funding that they extend to black businesses and recognize that as ownership. Our view is that that's their normal business, and if they want to extend that, and recognize this ownership, that will be a bit not acceptable, because it trivializes the whole purpose around ownership. But in terms of just the recognition of loans or financing to black businesses, like black industrialists and so forth, we believe that if entities would like to be recognized for that under any of the elements in the BBBEE, then at least there must be tangible differences between what they would offer in the normal course to a black business approaching them and what they are offering for purpose of recognition for transformation. So if there are terms must be clearly preferential. Terms must be very, you know, it must be clear that this is a product designed specifically for black people, and not that they design a product and because it's extended to a black person, therefore they get points for that. I think those are the issues, Chair, just, you know, in terms of just high level. You know, and we have our own questions just specifically about the Bay Hill model, but I suppose we can raise that later.
I just want to turn to the committee, though. Yes, Honourable Hill-Lewis, I didn't hear you.
Well, I've got some other questions, but I just want to ask a question of clarity on what the commissioners just said, if I may. Why is there a regulatory reason that the product needs to be only available to black people when the company itself is majority black owned? Can I just understand what the reason for that is, please?
Chair, what we are saying is that if the product is put on the table for recognition under BEE, then it must be different. It cannot be that if myself and Honourable Hill-Lewis go to a bank and we seek finance, the same terms are applicable to me as they are applicable to Honourable Williams, but then so you find that my loan then gets to give the entity points when there's nothing preferential about what has been given to me. It's the same as what would have been given to Honourable Williams. So what we're saying is that if the finance sector would like a product to be recognized as an empowerment product, then that particular product on the table that they seek recognition for, it must be significantly different from what they would offer to Honourable Williams. So that is basically the difference that we are trying to draw here. It mustn't just because this loan, on the same terms and conditions, it's not different, was offered to me just because I'm black, then it gets to be recognized for BE points.
Does that assist you, Honourable Hill-Lewis? You can come back later. Perhaps we can engage a bit further, but the door is still open. Honourable Williams, and let's see anyone else. Honourable Kurnoff, Honourable Mantash, Honourable Hill-Lewis. Honourable Hill-Lewis, right. Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. I just want quite a lot of clarity, I must be honest. I'm a bit confused. I'm just going to say what I think this model looks like, and then you can correct me. Peregrine owns 100% previously of Citadel, and Citadel owned 100% of Bay Hill. Now, AFG bought 51% of Citadel. Only of Bay Hill. So AFG owns no Citadel at all, nothing of Citadel. So it's just Bay Hill. So my question is, the 49% that's remaining is owned then by whom? Is it owned by Citadel or is it owned by Peregrine, you know, the mother company, the big company? Yeah, so I want to know exactly, because it sounds all very complicated. Why is it all so complicated? Why can't we just say AFG bought 51% of Bay Hill? What has all the other companies got to do with this deal? That's what I want to know. Why is it so convoluted? Is there a mechanism? Is there a way in which, I mean, why is it done like this? Is it done like this, you know, to, you know, mess around with the BE process? That's what I want to know. Thank you.
Thanks. No, there's no.
Just a minute. That's exactly what the content specialist was trying to get me to preempt. We're going to have the bank of questions because there may be some that engage on the same point. You see, right. And we then had the Honourable Colonel, followed by the Honourable Mantashe and Honourable Hill-Lewis.
Thank you, Chairperson. You know, obviously it is a little bit technical, but, you know,
I think it was clearly an attempt, you know, to make some sort of progress, and from the committee or from my side, you know, I must say thank you for that. My question is directly to AFG. You have bought now the 51% from Citadel, but are you happy that Citadel and Peregrine, the holding company, and Citadel now a very serious partner of your group, are you happy that they are doing what they should do in terms of transformation and in terms of, you know, what is expecting? Or are they just using this as a vehicle to put on their annual reports that they have now done what they should have done? Question again, are you happy that Citadel and Peregrine is doing what they should do in terms of transformation?
Thank you, Honorable Mantash.
Thank you, Chairperson. Maybe I have sort of a similar question. I wanted to ask, what is different from what your Sanlams and your old mutuals were doing to you, from what Citadel and that company, holding company, are doing now? Because in my other life, I knew of a deal that a certain investment company had the same arrangement with Sanlam. And Sanlam was a big brother there. That company wouldn't move an inch, and there were no dividends going to that company. All dividends were given to the holding company, and just a few, you know, a drops were getting into, and the company was not settling the debt. I'm seeing you talking of permanent and what is it that you're doing? Again, how do we, because we have the expertise, can you differentiate between what you are doing and the scams that we've seen in the market? For instance, I have a document here with me, something called Beat Club. Is this an investment company or is this a scam? Because we want to be able to save our people from scams that seem like genuine things at the face value, and underneath there's a hole that they would dip into at the end of the day. Thank you.
Honorable Mantashe, Honorable Hill-Lewis.
Thank you very much. Commissioner, it might be that I'm confused, but I need to get to the bottom of my confusion then. We have a group that has been bought by Dr. McLarty that is offering an empowerment investment vehicle, to go and invest in listed and unlisted companies as a strategic investment and as a permanent partner, as the gentleman has said. And that is worthy of our praise. But the vehicle itself is majority black owned through AFG. I don't understand why the vehicle's investors, retail investors, have to also be only black. Because what you're saying is that only black money can be, if you will excuse that crude term, only black people's money can be used to advance empowerment, which seems weird to me. Why can't white South Africans, who are also committed to empowerment, invest in an empowerment vehicle? So I don't understand why you say that the retail investors have to be also only black. And if you can please explain that to me, I'd appreciate it.
Honorable Hill-Lewis, I have a clarification, and that is, if I look at page 4, I think it is, there's a reference there to considerations around BBBE transactions, debt funding, etc., and lock-in periods. Then there's a sort of unpacking it, what this concern is, on page 7. And it then refers to transformational portfolios, and it says, on the one hand,
utilize black equity to further enhance economic transformation. But then it raises unintended consequences of BBBEE, such as lock-in structures and the revolving door of empowerment partners. And then there's the reference to black capital, which to some extent has been addressed. My concern here is, on the one hand, ever since the whole issue of how do we transform the economic structure and so on has been in South Africa, there's been this idea of different instruments and mechanisms. Do you give give a share to black workers to access this? Do you make such shares available? And then if you do, and it's in the person's name, then very soon it's just going to be sold. And then there's nothing you can do. So your intention to transform X isn't achieved because it is constantly or regularly resold to a white company or a person. And that was one of the issues with which a former Minister of Finance, Trevor Manuel, grappled with when they were looking at these issues. So how is it, you know, this idea of lock-in, because you talk about the unintended consequences of BBBEE. So you've heard, you know, there are quite a lot of comments and questions here. If this can be addressed as a whole, please.
That's great.
I'll go. Am I happy? Yes, I'm ecstatic. I would like you to imagine the year 2117. That's 100 years from now. With everything, we would not have these arguments. We hopefully the black people would have enough money to control the stock market and control the wealth. How do you get there? So, after 20 years, some black people have some money. And we estimate it's about 700 billion. But it's invested by white people who think the way they think. And maybe some of the black people would like this money to be invested in transforming themselves, their children, and perhaps the stock market, and perhaps the country, and even Africa, or maybe the world. How do you do it? You do it by harnessing that wealth, by collecting it. After you've collected it, what do? You look for people who are clever enough to be able to do the structure. Where did I find them? Within the Peregrine Group, and those who are good at collecting is Citadel. Those who are good at investing is Peregrine. Citadel was started in Pretoria, by the way, and was bought by Peregrine. So the same thing, collecting that black wealth and then using it to transform both the ownership as well as the management of business in South Africa. It does not mean that we'll not take any other type of wealth or money in that transformation. We'll be very happy to do so. However, there's the BEE Act and there's the Procurement Act, which says that there must be 51% black ownership. So in each and every structure, we will have 51% black ownership. So happy, very happy. Yes, we'll take white money, but only to be 49% of a structure, whatever structure it is. No, it's not a scam. We are registered with the stock market, not only the stock market, the FSP, Peregrine is in the stock market, it's a global company as well. So this is not a scam at all. Now, you mentioned something about is it, what is different? The difference is that today you give your money to Sanlam. I know most of your retirement money here is managed by Sanlam.
Yeah.
But you make laws here that says the money must be invested in Blackfin. How do you make sure that happens? If you are an ANC member, if you are an EFF member, how do you make that sure that that happens? This structure gives some hope in doing that, because you can now track, I can track my money and say in the stock market, my money is in that company and that company and that company. Even if it's a private share portfolio. Therefore, that's why we need high net worth black people who can then say, I've got 5 million, I've got 10 million, I've got 20 million. I wouldn't like my money to go and develop Sentin. I would like my money to develop Alexandra. This gives an opportunity for you to say so. I'll stop there and let the other answer go.
Madam, sorry, Chair, Madam Chair, I'd just like to, if possible, answer Sir, your first question with regards to the emphasis of the importance that was placed on shareholding and what is Peregrine going to do with it, or why is Citadel going to do that. I think the relevance of introducing those shareholding in a slide is really just to speak to the very succinct and clear deliverables that every shareholder in Bay Hill Capital has. And if you look for the rationale and the commerciality and the vision of the business, so Citadel are there purely to deliver the recipe and the operations. African Finance Group is there to deliver the strategy and the vision, the peopling and the resources of that business. And I think, you know, it goes without saying that our industry is increasingly, and so it should be, becoming highly regulated. Time to market in terms of doing these type of ventures can be quite onerous and long. And to try and do a green shoots and grow something like this from the bottom up can almost in as well scupper the whole business case. And I think that's the reason why Citadel was mentioned, only from the point of view is that they're very clear and succinct deliverables that every shareholder has. And Citadel, with the backing of the entire Peregrine Group, is there to ensure the success of this venture.
Blunt, are you coming in next?
I think hopefully most of the questions have been addressed. Maybe just to explain to the committee is. I'll talk to yours now. Maybe then just to make the one point I was going to make is please differentiate between the business of Bay Hill and the funds that we are launching. So our clients come invest in funds, and those funds will then be deployed into investment portfolios. So that's different to the structure of the business. The business itself is the business that, if you want to call it, manages those funds. In a regulated environment, those funds are protected. So it's if you invest in the funds and you've got 100 cents in a unit, that is regulated, and if the value of that net asset value goes to 1.10 rand, the value of your investment goes to 1.10 rand in the portfolio. And that's a very regulated, controlled environment. So from that perspective, it's not a scam. This is no different to any other asset manager out there who says, I'm going to build an investment portfolio. The difference is that we're actually changing the objectives of this investment portfolio. Most investment portfolios that you buy at Old Mutual or Sunlum or Coronation or Allan Gray, for example, focus on one thing only, and that is that they put their money into shares on the stock exchange and they try and maximize a return for their clients. If you buy the Old Mutual Equity Unit Trust or Sunlum Unit Trust, the objectives of our funds are different in that not only are we trying to earn a return, but we've also got a very clear social objective, and that's the aspect of transformation. And that comes into your question there about investors. For us to achieve those objectives and also get access into businesses as a BE partner and investor, we need to have black investors on board. So that would answer that question. Not exclusively. Yeah. In terms of the differentiation, then, in terms of us versus Mutual or Sanlam, again, it's just the objectives that we're going to, how we're going to deploy our clients' money. I don't know if that answers it.
Yes, the unintended consequences. Previously, I've been involved in transactions over the last 20 years. When you do a deal, you would be locked in, meaning you cannot sell. Because you have to finish the debt, the dividends, the incumbent. So, for argument's sake, when the oil price was 120 at Sasol and the share price was 600, you couldn't sell. The share price went to 23, you could do nothing as well. So you were just locked in. So that these structures, they help that situation in terms of the other unintended consequences is that there will be a time when the structure or the option, whatever structure it is in the money, meaning I'm the black investor, I would like to cash in. And when I cash in, my white partner loses his empowerment status. And therefore, the black partners would be revolved. So it's called the revolving door of empowerment. And those are the unintended.
Bay Hill, Honourable Williams, did you want to do a follow-up? Does anyone else want to do a follow-up before the Commissioner comes in again? Right, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't mean to keep taking us back, but I don't understand. So let me try again, because it seems to me that Peregrine and Citadel, they're not black-owned companies. They're not 51% black-owned companies. So they're doing they're working with Bay Hill to basically what you said to us to try and secure the 700 billion rand in new emerging money that's out there. So it's almost, for me, it's almost as if Bay Hill is basically fronting for Citadel and Peregrine. So if you could just explain to me why that isn't the case. Because Bay Hill is the BE 51% company. So you take that company to the investors, the middle class, the emerging middle class, the 700 billion rands, and then the work or the processes of investment. You said that Peregrine was the strategy, and if that's the case, then I'm a bit concerned about if Peregrine is 100% white owned, then this whole story about Bay Hill, investing in the upliftment of our people. If Peregrine is doing the strategy for this process, how does that work? So I just want to know, it's Peregrine, Citadel, and then this BE company right at the front. What are the BE statuses of the other companies? Thank you.
Thank you.
Look, the discussion about Citadel being owned by Peregrine and then Bayle as a subsidiary, this is a legacy business. This is the structure of the business. We've had it in place for a number of years. So this wasn't a newly created business. Maybe to put it in context, the operating structure of Peregrine Holdings is to take significant stakes in various financial services businesses. Some are branded Peregrine, so you get a business called Peregrine Securities. It's the largest stockbroker in the country. You get a business called Stenham, which is a large trust and fiduciary business. You get Citadel, which is one of the largest and, let's say, high-end or premium wealth management firms. There's hedge businesses. There's a whole, it's going to call it a family of businesses. It just so happens that when we started putting this together, we felt that if you want to implement a vision of building transformational portfolios in the country, that the best place to house them was in a business called Bay Hill, which already targets and builds interesting and different, if you want to call it alternative investment strategies. That, you know, I've spoken about earlier, and I use the term traditional investing. That's, you know, traditional investing, going buy some shares on the stock exchange and hope to earn a return. That was just a unique approach where Bayle does things differently in the group. So there's no intention that this is sort of a third level of fronting. The key thing is that this is unencumbered 51% shares, with AFG bringing in its staff, its expertise into the business. In fact, the other way you could rather put it is that this is a subsidiary. This is a subsidiary of AFG, and it happens to have Citadel as a shareholder in it, as an external smaller shareholder.
Thank you.
So it's very simple. There's no, and from you asked the questions about dividends being paid and funny things like that. It's 51%. Not yet. 51% is AFG. Yeah. It's very transparent, and it's just a vehicle that we think is great within the group to be able to build and create a private sector driven transformation initiative in the country.
Honourable Mantash, on the mic, please.
Sorry, I'm thinking loud.
I'm
not an EFF member. I just want clarity. What is the relationship between these two companies, these Citadel and Pinnacle? Do they have the same directors?
No, not at all, ma'am.
What is the relationship?
Madam, Peregrine is a listed entity. Peregrine is the holding company, and there are five subsidiaries that sit beneath Peregrine, of which Citadel is one of the subsidiaries. Different governance, different board of directors. There is obviously some cross-holding in terms of the CEO of a Peregrine Group will also sit on the Citadel board because of the shareholding nature, but apart from that, it's two separate governance bodies.
Yes, I think you can see that it's provoked a lot of discussion here and discourse because it is unusual, the structure. And I mean, I looked here at the transformational fund, etc., about trying to ensure that the funding, or rather that Bay Hill, even though it moved capital in and out, the overall pool of capital will remain invested and the company will retain its black ownership status. I think it's, this is quite, I suppose, perhaps because it's somewhat an unusual structure that we're trying to get our heads around it. Finance would normally deal with this. Why are we dealing with it as trade and industry? Because it deals directly with broad-based black economic empowerment. And that is why I'd like the Commissioner just, it's the first time the Commissioner is really hearing this and clearly is not going to make the last comment on this. She would want to study this. The Commission would want to study this. But any comments at this stage, Commissioner, before perhaps in time you return to us?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, like you correctly point out, we haven't gone through this, but I've had the opportunity to just do a search on the internet. The one thing that that struck me was the fact that the Bay Hill website doesn't have mention of this transaction. So the structure is not there. So I'm not sure, maybe in terms of the timing, when was this transaction entered into? Perhaps maybe if they can also share what was the BBB status of Bay Hill before the transaction and after the transaction. And also, there's also a BE Trust that seems to also be in the structure of Peregrini. And so I suppose the question that Honorable Koronoff was asking about the BE status of each and every one of these entities is relevant in a sense that we need to know what is the status of these entities, Citadel, Peregrini itself, Bay Hill, pre and post the transaction. That would be useful. But I think for us as the Commission, I think what would be interesting is to see the shareholders' agreement for this 51%. We've already said what our concerns are about these 51% structures, because what we pick up ordinarily is that what is supposed to be an acquisition by a black entity is like the entity, the 49% entity is the one acquiring the 51% entity. Often, so if you look at the detail of the transaction and the contracts, you find things that make it not like an acquisition of a black entity into a white entity. But we cannot say that until we've seen what is in there to say whether the structure is a solid 51% control and an influence over the business that is being acquired. Then, Chair, there's also other aspects, like, for instance, there are deliverables that are conditional to AFG. Again, the detail of those deliverables will determine whether, in fact, there is an acquisition, because what we pick up is that the conditions that are put in the agreements sometimes cancel the acquisition part. So you acquire 51%, but you stripped off all of the powers that you can exercise under that 51%. So until we see the contract, would not be able to say whether this has got that element. So a 51% ordinarily is control, is ownership, but the provisions in the shareholders agreement, and the, especially also in if there's a finance agreement, it will be important to look at that. Chair, the reason why I'm talking about the finance agreement is that we have a case that we are dealing with where a black shareholder who borrowed 19 million has now paid over 60 million back to the financing company. So in a BEE transaction. So you start then wondering whether this was a financing transaction or whether actually ownership was being acquired by somebody using a black front. So the financing arrangements, if there are any contracts that relate to this structure, would be glad to look into them. And again, Chair, I think if the parties could also make it clear, you know, a clear distinction between whether this is an investment scheme or an ownership scheme. Because when we talk ownership, there's issues around voting rights. There's issues around net value. There's issue about economic interest that must flow. So those three elements must be there for us to say this is ownership. So if we can distinguish that, then I think it will also make life easy for us. But at the moment, we're not able to say whether this is a good deal or not. But we do appreciate the fact that what they're trying to do is what, in fact, the BBBE legislation is encouraging, especially investment into various entities, especially investment in black in new companies and new entities. Chair, I would leave it at that. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Commissioner, but also thank you to Bay Hill Capital, because it is important that we have what I would call almost case studies. This is we're right at the beginning of this, and we want to try and unpack this as much as possible to ascertain, is this going to be a good example and structure for us to pursue and back? We don't know. That's the situation. As we sit here, I doubt that anyone sitting here right now can say, right, first class, this is it. So we are still, we're out, if you like, on this matter. We will await, of course, as well, the Commissioner coming back to us with further information, plus yourselves, because you want this to work, Dr. Mashlati. I certainly wouldn't go along with your idea that we look at 100 years from now. If that's what we're genuinely thinking, I think we will have had a coup long before then. So I would prefer to shorten this to a period of 10, you know, 15 years, not 100 years from now. I think that really is stretching it. And I think you've only got to look wherever this has come about to know that that would not have a positive outlook at the end. But I do want to thank the three of you for coming here, sharing this with us, and so that we can look at it ourselves. It's the first time we have, as a committee, engaged directly with such a company. So thank you once again. Right. Committee members, we have crafted something on the basis of our resolution indicating to, is it our legal services, the parliamentary legal, what is Mr. Frankie, Advocate Frankie? We've just asked him you know, is this the way that we can pursue this issue? We are going to ask them again, but as we understand it, we also have recourse to a summons, etc. And we would like to know if we are on track issuing it ourselves per se, or would this be another structure, say the Speaker's office. So we're trying to ensure that this is the case because, as you know, from time to time we've done things with very good intentions, only to find we slipped up here in the process. We don't want this to be a slip-up. We do believe we can, but let's ensure that this is the case. And we are, meanwhile, going ahead to invite them, but we're also making them aware that Parliament can summon them, you know, if necessary. So I am going to come back to you, Honourable Macpherson, but this will be done with the ninth, right. Yes, just on this issue, though, Honourable Macpherson.
Yeah, Chair. I want to just get some clarity. Are we inviting them again, or are we instructing them to be here again?
That on this occasion, which we didn't the first time, we simply invited them, that on this occasion, it's literally be warned, not that that is the phrase we use, that we can and will summons you. And remember, a summons in the end would not necessarily suit them the day, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that there needs to be a process undertaken here. Honourable Macpherson?
Yeah, you obviously have a lot more faith than I do, because there will be another conference that they will have to go to, there will be someone else will be sick again, and there will be another one-page report tabled. And then we're going to have the same discussion again, and we're going to wring our hands and say, how dare they? And then we'll set up another meeting and ask them.
Chairperson, I think it's reasonable what we're doing. In the letter that we send them now, we say either you come on the 9th or we're going to summons you whenever we feel we want to, type of thing. And I think we should give them that reasonable, because the initial invitation didn't say anything like that. So I think we should send them one more letter that says come or get summonsed, and then that's it. And then we act on it if they don't come. Yeah.
We don't need to bring it back to the committee then. Honourable Colonel?
Just to say, Chairperson, there is an invitation in both letters, either from Woolworths and ShopRite Checkers. If we're not happy, we must come back. And we must say there is a real need to interrogate them. We want them here in verbal form. And if not, we just remind them of our powers.
No, I do think it is the more reliable and responsible approach. Now, that is the program. Am I right?
Yeah.
The other thing, on this issue, no, we'll just wait then because we're dealing with another issue. On the other matter about the National Lotteries Commissioner, you know, the appointment thereof, I think you've got the necessary documentation. There are a series of questions, etc., that I would like... you know, a representative from different political parties, as it were, to discuss with myself, as it were, on the Friday morning. I'm thinking of yourself, Honourable Hill Lewis, you're in Cape Town. We'll ask someone from the EFF, and then the IFP, if they can. If they can't, then I certainly would just go ahead with a couple of ANC, but I think it's wise to bring in other parties just to ensure we are on track with our questions. Do we agree? And that would be an hour's meeting at the very most on Friday. Is that right, Mr. Herman? Right. Could you address the committee on the program, Mr. Herman?
I haven't forgotten, Honourable Maxwell.
Chair, the members do not have the program with me because there are going to be a number of changes to the program. The issue regarding the workshop, starting the afternoon, because parties have indicated there will be a caucus on Thursday morning. So no caucus on Thursday. They've indicated when we plan. So I'm going to still have to ascertain from the ANC if they're still proceeding with the caucus or not. Otherwise, if the ANC does not proceed, we'll move back to the morning session. National Treasury has some challenges on this Thursday.
So what time will it be? Is it in the afternoon?
1:30 in the afternoon, but there's no caucus. If there's no caucus for ANC as well, then we'll probably shift it back to the morning session, which will be 9:30.
No, 10 o'clock.
Oh, 10 o'clock. And then we will, National Treasury has indicated they have the challenge of attending the Thursday session. So the chair has suggested that we proceed with DTI making the presentation, and National Treasury will come the following Wednesday, the 10th of May, to make their presentation on the issues that we've raised on that regard. The other issue is that the paltry issue will come in on the 9th of May, which will probably go in beyond 1 o'clock, because it'll be having the NEF in the first session of the morning to 11 o'clock, and if we have all the retailers, I can't see us not.
Yeah.
We'll go beyond one. Then the other, it will be a shift, but that's they don't have it. Yeah, that's internal. But that would be the program that will be submitted going forward.
So sorry, is it the housekeeping issue?
Yes. No, not on the Tuesday. We check on the Tuesday, not on Tuesday. It's the program currently states there's no sitting on the Tuesday. It may change.
Look, we can only work according to what we've been issued. I know that this changes quite rapidly. But the other thing is that members be reminded, the National Credit Regulator will be there tomorrow, and we will be, as far as I'm aware, we're starting at 9 o'clock in Good Hope Chambers.
Tomorrow,
you remember we're doing the financial, what is it, sector, whatever, and the National Credit Regulator is there, part, and as well as someone else. So that's a joint process. The other issue is...
it's on the program, too.
Pardon?
It's on the program.
Two matters on the program, if I may, before we move on. Just one quick administrative matter. If we can please receive the program via email as soon as possible... today, if that's possible, yeah. Then, obviously I haven't seen the draft program, so this might already be on it, but you will recall that the NRCS committed to addressing their backlog by the end of March 2017. Most of April we were not here, but we need to check with them exactly what their progress is. Have they gotten rid of their entire backlog as they promised? All of the updated figures on that.
For the reminder, Honourable Hill Lewis, that is important to track it. Yes, Honourable McPherson.
Yeah, Chair, you'll also recall that the committee committed to also following the ICT program for the NRCS, and they need to come and brief us where they are, because they're supposed to be going live in December. So, on top of what the Honourable Hill Lewis has said, they also need to give us the updates on the ICT system.
And then, Will, if anyone else can just think of something we may have overlooked, do try and get the schedule to everyone today. And then what we can do at the very least, if there is some huge problem, we could alter it tomorrow morning. All right. Our budget debate, Mr. Hermans. Anyway, yes, Honourable McPherson.
Chairperson, last week in the Etekweni Committee for Economic Development, they tabled a report, which I'm happy to send to you, or however you want me to direct it. In the Municipal Council. And they provided a false account of what this committee's position has been on poultry. That we had resolved that government should buy failing farms. This was a report that was tabled to the committee and to the executive committee. Now, that is complete misrepresentation and factually untrue, even though it was pointed out to them. And I think that it's very, I think that it's problematic when other spheres of government are misrepresenting what this committee does or does not do to suit whatever agenda they are trying to push through. And I think that either through the committee or through the speaker, that a letter should be tabled to them asking them to withdraw in a committee that factually untrue statement, because that now goes on the record in Etekweni that this is what this committee believes. So I will send that document to you via email, and if you can please decide what is the best course of action to take, because it's caused huge, huge problems in the municipality, you know, with farmers and businesses and all sorts of things.
What I think we will do officially, as it were, although of course we welcome the initial report, as it were, we will ask you, Mr. Hermans, to write to them immediately indicating we have been made aware that this is the case. We would like a copy this week so that we can address this. And then when we've got it right here, we'll be meeting again Thursday, aren't we? We'll take it and say we would appreciate having this. It's already a report there. We would like it Wednesday afternoon, tomorrow afternoon. And then I think it is very important, we've done this once before, for us to set the record straight. But let's get it right here and take a committee decision on the matter. Do we agree? And I think on that note, am I right? I think on that note, the meeting is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 9 at Good Hope, the joint meeting, and then our own meeting on Thursday, and we will just confirm
morning or afternoon.
Mr. Hermans is just going to ascertain the ANC and other parties on the matter. All right. Thank you very much, and thanks for the remaining here. I apologize about the catering, but apparently the April holiday period